Hey everyone, welcome back to the Blessed Child Podcast. This is your host, Renee, aka Ren Robot. This week I spoke with the activist Teddy Hose, who is an artist and writer based in Brooklyn, New York. If you haven't heard part one, go back and listen, because this is part two of The Church of Bad Dads. Yes, this week I'm dropping three episodes. This is bonus content on bonus content. I have been very busy with some wonderful people bringing a lot of information to the forefront that I think is important, and so that's why I've dropped episode after episode. And yeah, so that's what's going on here at Blessed Child Podcast. I hope you enjoy the rest of this conversation that I had with Teddy Hose. We're going to pick up on talking about our experience with the Special Task Force. And for those of you who are not familiar, that was the name for mobile fundraising team in the Unification Church. And it is now called GPA, or Generation Peace Academy. Essentially, it is just labor trafficking and fundraising door-to-door, business-to-business, bar-to-bar, in very unsafe practices. So here we go into part two, The Church of Bad Dads with Teddy Hose. I don't know. I remember having like a lot of panic when I got out of OLT, not knowing like if my decision to go to school for this was selfish or if I was making the right choices to have a family. Like, what do you, like, I know you're a very active speaker. How has that influenced you?
Well, when I think about, right after I left SDF, and that's a story in itself too. I've told this on some other podcasts, but like my mom always, she was always really good about Christmas. Like, as the time the family got together is when my dad came home and stuff, you know, because honestly, I would only see my dad like 2 or 3 weeks out of the year when I was a little kid. So she wanted me to come back for Christmas. Like, I did a second year of STF just because I was like, again, like kind of peer pressured into it and avoiding, you know, having to choose my career course or whatever. But And she got on the phone with me and I resisted. I was like, no, I want to stay. And you know, looking back, I remember my team leader for my fundraising team was this Japanese member who was like guilting me. He was like, you know, none of the other kids are going back home for Christmas. And then, you know, so so this is where, you know, when people say, you know, STF is like a re-indoctrination program for second generation, like right there, that's it, you know? And when I told, like, I called her once and I told her, no, I'm not flying back home. And she argued with me. She really wanted me to come home. And I think she also was like, oh no, this is the CARP shit that I grew up with and, or that I was in the church and faced. And like, I had to like walk away from. So she was fighting hard. And I remember seeing that team leader, like he, like, I know this is an audio podcast, but he put his hands over his mouth. He was like, and smiled. He was so proud of me that I was fighting my mom to stay in this fucking cult. So like, anyway, yeah. And, but luckily my mom, she called again and she successfully got me to come back. And I felt so like, defeated. And like, for like, even like probably like up to a year or two after, I was like, should I go back to STF? Should I go back to, even when I was going to Bridgeport, I was like, oh, like any problem I had or any situation, I was like, it's because I didn't finish STF, you know, like it really, yeah, set in deep. I mean, there's some serious trauma there. So, I mean, you know, I learned how to work hard. I learned that I have the capacity to like stay up all night and work or whatever, like, you know, so I got that out of it, became more of a workaholic confidently. And I became more ambitious as a person. Like, you know, I think it helps in that way, but it's very toxic also. Like it gutted out any kind of sense of personal space. And like, I remember going to a concert for the first time after. It was like Tribe Called Quest with the Beastie Boys. I was like, holy crap, this is awesome, like New York hip hop show. And I didn't feel anything. I was like numb from my like head to toe. Like, I didn't feel anything at this concert. I just was so detached, like from the kid I was, like who used to watch shows at 8 o'clock every night. And like, it just ripped me out of culture. And I don't know. I mean, I feel like people listening to this who went to STF, who didn't really look back critically, are going to be like, oh, come on, it was great. It like helped me out so much. And I'm more ambitious. I take more risks. And yeah, you get that too. But I think, especially as like an artist, like it was not good. Like it just, and I like coming back to my friends, and I lost a friend because I, oh my God, I just cringe when I think about this. Like she called me on the phone. I kind of had a crush on her too. And like, I just went on about like, oh, we're living in the last days, you know? Oh, we're, and she's like, what do you mean by that? And I was like, oh, well, you know, I think that I said something, you know, biblical or divine principle. Anyway. Yeah. And she never called again. We had kept in touch through STF. Like she was writing like letters and, you know, and I thought she was really cool. She was also mixed race like me. And like, anyway, that sucked.
Oh my God. You're the first person to touch on it's kind of like a withdrawal or like this. I mean, STF is a huge psychological, like it's a psychological cult. Like that's a whole category in and of itself, just that you weren't in touch with like the feelings of pleasure. Same with me. Like they warned you. They warned me on SOLT. They were like, okay, this is the last workshop we're going to have. Remember to keep your faith strong, build your life of faith. It's going to be a big rocky test when you leave. You're going to feel there's going to be a withdrawal from the spiritual side and God, this is going to be a big test. A lot of people, like, it's like a detox, and they warn you about it. And they say, dig deeper into your life of faith. And they do. They're like, get up at 7, do your 100K, even if you're by yourself, still go deeper. It's going to be shaky ground. But also I lost a sense of pleasure. Like you went to a concert and you couldn't even enjoy it.
No, it's just because I felt so detached from everything. And like, you know, I learned later in brain science, like, you know, your neural pathways physically change to like create new pleasure centers. If you achieve these goals, then you get pleasure. So to me, like in my brain, I was still like, if I make enough money for the cults that I said I was going to make in the beginning of the day, then I can feel pleasure. You know, that was the new pleasure source.
Oh my God, you're right. That was the dopamine hit. Cause we did wake up at 6 and they're like, okay, what's your internal goal? Okay. You want to be less selfish. Okay. What's your external goal? Oh, break $200. Okay. So now you're correlating, motivation, which is a huge dopamine release, with goals and happiness. It totally rewired you. Do that for a year. All you're going to think about is money for internal satisfaction.
Yeah. I think the hardest part for me is, yeah, that's a great observation. The hardest part for me was like, just going, as I was saying, and I forgot, this might be a trauma thing too. I do tend to lose short-term memory. Like,
anyway, it's abuse amnesia. You don't, you have to keep, you know, SCF, I think people look at with rose colored glasses, like, oh, remember all the times we bathed in the ocean? That was so glorious. Remember all those bread donations that we got when people, you know, they were nice to us. Like, you remember sleeping? I remember sleeping on the beach. Like that was so much fun, but like,
yeah,
it was still like awful.
A homeless person. Yeah.
Yeah. It was still awful. Like staph infections.
But it's a bonding experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And you grew, you opened up, you learned how to approach strangers in the middle of the Walmart parking lot. Like, you're not shy anymore. Like, yeah, there was some good things that happened, but also, yeah, our brains, I can't even remember half this shit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was so dangerous too, but yeah, what I was going to say before is that when I read about it, when I read about, you know, the effects of a cult, like there's that book, Take Back Your Life by Yanya Lalich and Madeline Tobias, you know, way later I read about that, like my mid late 30s, and it talked about PTSD. And I was like, oh, I thought that was just a military thing. And it was like, no, what I experienced was PTSD. It spelled it out. It was like, you know, do not have feelings in these areas anymore. I'm like, kind of, yeah. And it's like, oh, it is. I mean, STF is, it's a lot like a military boot camp, and, you know, self-denial, you know, that's it. And yeah, for another documentary I interviewed for recently, or like a docuseries, they had me focus on how it was like militant. You know, in the 1995 Camp Sunrise workshop in New York, they had a week called like hell training. And there was like, I think it was like the nephew of Reverend Moon. There was a guy named Sun Am Moon, and he was leading it. And he was like, he always had his hands behind his back, like, okay, we're going to do da da da, like kind of like a drill sergeant. And he was just soaking up like the charismatic. He had this like charismatic smile of like, yeah, like you're going to go through hell and I'm going to like, you know, I'm going to train you to be soldiers of God. And we had to do all these like physical things, like rolling around on the like basketball court in the gravel and like stuff. Some stuff was hurt, you know, like I've heard other second or people grew up in the Moonies, like who described it as torture. I'm like, yeah, it was kind of torture. It's that. And also you can compare it to like hazing, you know, with fraternities. It was a very macho, patriarchal, you know, proving ground kind of thing. And then, you know, we judged each other by that, like, except for the smart ones who are like, this is dumb. Like, I'm just here because my parents are here. Like, I respect the hell out of them now.
Yeah, looking back on those rebellious kids. No, what you're saying with the, we were a psychological cult. It was also a military cult. Like, even the language, chariot, kembe. Nobody says chariot. I was talking to a Korean. I was like, chariot, is that like a thing? They're like, what the hell? Like, why are you, that's a military thing. I was like, what? That's what we were told like every morning. Chariot. like, kyeombae. It's like, what the fuck? And monte, like, come on now. All the language is so weird and loaded. If you talk to a native Korean speaker, it's very military.
Yeah, it's Moon's military fetish. I mean, he was born in North Korea before it was like, you know, before the 38th parallel. And, but maybe it was still kind of militant there. It's like, where did he get all this? And like, I don't know. Well, I know it's from trauma from, you know, the North Korean prison camp. That's where he learned how to.
And I mean, the remnants of that type of structure echo in the Unification Church, and we've all got psychological damage that mimics, you know, what we're reading in these books about PTSD, war vets, North Korean war POWs, like, because Moon came from that place, like, and then replicated the culture to lots of us. It's just it's bizarre how similar that our minds and our trauma is to POWs. Prisoners of war.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think that's why he did so well in America too. And he probably helped create this atmosphere of, you know, now we're, I mean, the whole reason I became a whistleblower is because like Trump was running for president and I was like, uh-oh, this is the same wave I felt in the cults, like the same far-right propaganda. And like this charismatic leader is way more powerful than people think. I didn't think he was going to become president, but you know, I don't know. When Pussy Riot said that, you know, the same thing happened with Putin. They're like, take this seriously. Like, we all treated Putin like a joke until he became in power. I was like, oh no, Trump is going to become president, you know? Like, anyway, but what I was saying with that is like, you know, in America, we have like the prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex, you know? Yes. We have this, like, what I heard it described as was like, you know, why are men afraid to be emotional and like stuff like that, you know, in this country? And it's like, because we're preparing them to be, you know, just these soldiers. And, you know, it's like when you have too much power at the top and they treat everyone like minions and like, and it's that America is the most religious of the wealthy nations. I didn't know that until recently too. There's like a Pew Research article from 2018 that talks about that. There's so much religion in such a wealthy country where, you know, we do have a lot of good educational facilities, but I don't know. You know, and the reason I question how much Moon has an impact on it is because perfect metaphor is that he gave millions to Jerry Falwell's Liberty University, which is this like far right, you know, I don't know what they're teaching, but it's like probably similar to the Moonies. It's probably this like alternate spiritual timeline that denies a lot of America's, you know, wrongdoings. Like I'm pretty sure they don't really teach much about slavery there. The Japanese internment camps. That's in these American nationalist narratives. I usually see them wash over that or saying it wasn't so bad, or, you know, worst case is like Ben Carson, who's black, is like, the slaves had a, or he didn't say slaves. He's like, the immigrants or whatever he said had a difficult life at first from Africa. Like, everyone was like, wow, you're a brain surgeon. That someone needs to operate on you, bro.
Oh my God. Yeah, Jerry Falwell, I think he got like 2.5 or 3.5 million, and his name comes up a bunch with a lot of influence that Moon had.
Yeah, I'll just add real quick. He also is credited as the person who brought religion into politics. Like, you know, when they make policies a certain way, he's the one who like, and I wonder if Moon had to do with that too, if he was like, this is what they're doing to you, Jerry, and your people. Like, because this was in like the 50s when Moon came here.
Oh, wow. Anyway,
but like, but I don't know. That's
no, I mean, no, what you're saying is like, yeah, once Moon got Jerry Falwell, like he would, like, as soon as prosecution started against the Unification Church as a criminal organization, he would be like, no, religious freedom. And then like everybody would be like, don't prosecute the Moonies. They're just, it's just a new world religion. It's just, he paid for lip service. And Jerry Falwell was right behind him. So, I mean, he was very influential.
Yeah. And I think it's called the Religious Freedom Foundation or something like that. I have to look this
sounds
up
so later, familiar.
But it's weird because, okay, this is on the Scientology website. I was just doing some research and Dan Pfefferman, who was like a prominent church member from like Maryland or DC, like he is the leader of the Religious Freedom Foundation. And the Scientology website has a page for that. So it's like all these cults, like they don't even care. They're just like working together to fight against intelligence, really. They're anti-intelligence and they're just they're fighting against things that are happening and are proven by experts because they want to have this heroic narrative. You know, it's awful. Yeah, it's just rich people trying to protect their money with religion because they know that religion is very sacred to people. And that's kind of how I see it, you know, and maybe they believe they're so deluded.
I don't think these people are rich. Like Neil Sloan is not that rich. Actually, I looked him up. They're not that rich now. Like you would think they'd be on par with the Moons after years and years of working on those missions. But I think they're just idealists.
Yeah. Well, when you get old in the church, then you lose your money, right? Unless you're like a Korean leader or someone who is in a position to reap the, you know, harvest of money from other
people. The businesses. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, sadly, a lot of people, you know, because they never learn financial competence and it's all magical thinking of spiritual this or that. Money comes because God, like,
yeah,
when you get old and you can't work anymore or like you lose your position of power because you're getting old, like they just, yeah, they boot people right out and they're like, all right, who's next? Or like, oh, let's have this Korean leader take over because he's from like the chosen nation, you know, like.
It's also got to be hard now that we're generations deep to leave the Moon organization if your entire family and yourself depend on them for your wealth and your income. It's like, how do you feel safe to leave? Like, would you jeopardize somebody else in your family by leaving and talking? And it's just so sticky.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, you know, my family, us siblings, we have to send money to my parents every month, like after they left, because my dad paints murals, you know, I mean, good on him for doing the art thing after, you know, we moved. But yeah, it's such a crazy story. 5 kids in the house, moving to Bellevue, Washington, which is like, again, the Beverly Hills of Seattle. And my dad wants to suddenly do art to like make a living for this family. And like, yeah, I think I was talking with my sister recently. She said we went up to like over $80,000 in credit card debt. So thank God there were like these like 1-800 like nonprofits that help you pay down your debt that were like, there were commercials for that. And that's how they did it, you know? And we had, you know, food from a food bank and like, I don't know. I think maybe a lot of members, like before there was GoFundMe, helped out my parents. Like, I don't know how they made it through. I imagine there was a lot of, yeah, like sympathy for them, you know, like there was a lot of solidarity with members or certain generations of members who, you know, I think with my parents, again, they were like respected. So from the early days, that's my theory, but also the $80,000 in debt and, you know, just financial incompetence. And my mom is like, don't ever get a credit card. They'll trick you. Did it. That's what she taught us about credit cards when we were kids, because she fell into so many because she was vulnerable and she needed money. So, you know, my mom's handicapped. She's in a wheelchair. She was stuffing envelopes. She was like, you know, doing all the jobs that she could do because my dad's income was unsteady as an artist. And it's so insane to think about. But, you know, like we kids, we just paid for our own college. We went to a lot of student loan debt. A lot of them went to the University of Washington because it was like, if you were already a resident, then it's cheaper tuition. Me, I guess maybe because of STF, I was like, now I'm this like super ambitious person that deserves to like go all the way. And I went to New York, and well, Bridgeport, and then New York, Bridgeport to start, and like, you know, ended up way more debt than they did. It took till I was in my late 30s to pay it off. But oh, And that's another whole conversation. It's messed up too. I appreciate what Elizabeth Warren has been, you know, fighting against these corrupt like student loan companies like Navient, man, screw them, man. I hope they burn to the ground. Like, anyway, it's just like exploitation out of exploitation has been like my whole, like, you know, childhood and young adulthood. And now I'm like, for the first time ever, I bought new furniture. Like, it arrived last week. I'm like, wow, it's a huge step in my 40s now. So yeah.
Well, you weren't prepared. You weren't ever prepared for financial, you know, competency. Like, exploitation was the name of the game growing up, Mooney.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, to be fair, it happens in a lot of ways, and especially in American society. Unfortunately, the wealth gap is so wide. I'm very sensitive to things like that because of having experienced it. So I really try to make, you know, the right decisions. My air conditioner is like low emissions for like environmental reasons. Like, I always look for a recycle bin. Well, that's also living in Seattle, the evergreen state. But I try not to contribute to companies that are, you know, part of the damage, but are so ubiquitous. Like, you know, I bank with like a union supporting bank, and I encourage people to bank with credit unions, which it's right under our noses, everyone. Like, there's no shareholders with credit unions. Like, whoever contributes, like, you're the shareholders. So there's no agenda and there's no fees and there's no lawsuits. Like, you won't find lawsuits. Look up any major bank on Google and the word lawsuit, and you'll find stuff within the past month. I promise you. Like, it's a constant, like, yeah, but it's just so ubiquitous. It's always been how this country, you know, was. Like, we started with slaves and we've been spoiled ever since. You know, I think we just find it in other ways now, in prison, or like, you know, sweatshops overseas. We have to become disciplined and do our own work if we really want to, like, you know, work things out. Like, that's how I see things. Yeah.
Thank you for that capitalist soapbox. I like that.
It's from experience, you know? So, I mean, geez, my dad went from world missionary colonizing countries to leaving and becoming an artist. Like, what do you expect?
Jesus. Wait, he left the church and also became an artist, or was he an artist in the church?
He did calligraphy of, like, if you go to some old members' houses, they'll have my dad's calligraphy of like Reverend Moon's words. But then he did calligraphy of like more, you know, Theodore Roosevelt or Martin Luther King, or, you know, he expanded. I don't think he was ever totally in the church. He actually like told me in the early 70s he had his doubts, but I think he was too involved. He didn't have much to fall back on. He came from a poor family. He grew up as a foster kid for like most of his childhood. And I think he just, you know, it's like, how can you say no? It's like you have stability for the first time in your life, you know, thanks to this human trafficking empire, and it all looks utopian. So, you know, and it's just hard.
Kids too, with a foreign wife, like, you feel kind of like you kind of got to stay put or everything's going to fall apart.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting, his story. So when I was in San Francisco, I lived in San Francisco from like 2009 to 2021. And he came down there one time. They had kind of a reunion with like the veteran members, who again are kind of like the oldest members are like pseudo members. Some of them maybe are still in it, more in it than others, but you can tell by the look on their face that they're like sage and like they're over it. They're like, enough with all this like extremism crap. Like, I don't know, but also like some of them, one of them was talking about, well, I think the Tea Party is blah, blah, at the time, you know, which is the Koch brothers' creation of a radical group for like far right conservatives. Anyway, so a lot of them lean politically right, not all of them. But anyway, they were having a dinner and they invited me. And I was like, at the time I was like kind of investigative. So I was like, oh, excellent. You know, so I went to this dinner with like the church veterans from San Francisco in the 60s, you know? And it was at this house where they had their kind of like local leader, Papa San Che, as they called him. I think his name was like Sun Hawk Che, I don't know. And Mama San Che, who was like his wife. And they're also kind of like, okay, well, to give you an idea of what they're like, because Papa San Che seemed to kind of have his own thing, and like he over there, and my dad felt like he was actually in his group, you know, and like he was not as militant, I guess, according to my parents. He was a little more kind of hippy dippy and like, you know, low key. Moon didn't like that. So someone ratted him out, another local leader, and Moon came and broke it up in 1971. Yeah, he was like, you know, you, your family moved to this state, you guys moved to this state. So my family moved to DC at the time where I was born and then moved to New York after.
I interviewed Steve Cappellini, who was in the Moonies in the 70s, and he said he went to a Boonville retreat up in California that was owned by Papa San, I call him Papa San Choi, but Papa San Che and Oni Durst.
Yeah. Those were the leaders of that region, yeah. And they kind of competed, like the Durst and the Chase.
Yeah, so that's who Moon broke up?
No, he broke up like, there was a community of the Chase, and they were in San Francisco. It is the Bay Area. And then across the Bay, in the East Bay, there was Oni Durst's congregation, you know? So like, So I don't know. It seems like there was some competitiveness and
interesting.
Yeah. And then that happened and yeah, it's weird. It's like, there's like cults within the cult.
Maybe Moon was like, there's too much power here. Like, I feel like I'm not getting it all. Y'all are not bowing down to me enough, like break it up.
Yeah, exactly. Like I read this thing, you know, Michael Mickler, who acts as kind of a documentarian of, he kind of records the Unification Church history. And he's also, again, like kind of a veteran member who's kind of over it. So he actually documents it in a somewhat critical way, which is pretty amazing. I tend to believe it as much, even though he's still, I guess, on paper, a church member. And he talked about how Papa San Che was the guy, he went around Japan first, and he was the one who brought like communal living to the Unification Church. So compounds and stuff like that. And he was like very much an innovator. Just like pretty much like everyone who made the church good. And like, you know, there's also, what's her name? Oh God, what's her name? She wrote the original Divine Principle. Young-un Kim. Yeah. Young-un Kim, like she was an innovator of a lot of things in the church, and she made it kind of like feel good. And she started out, I think, in Eugene, Oregon, was like the first landing of the American Unification Church. And like she, I don't know, I guess they moved to the Bay Area from there. I don't know that whole history, but she also made it good. And she wrote the original text of the book of the Unification Church, the Divine Principle. And Moon just took credit for all of that, you know, like he's just like, this is mine. So people, you know, attribute a lot of things to Moon, but you know, he's a con man. Like it's true. He's a con man. So this is what they do best.
Pause right here and insert some information about Young-un Kim, because she's a key figure. She was a professor at Ewha University. She did a lot for Moon. So I'll just put a little blip in here because I think that's important.
Yeah. And maybe you can put this in your show notes, but I was kind of taken aback that one of the hosts of a cult podcast in his episodes about the Moonies, this guy Armando.
I love him.
Yeah, he's great. He's hilarious. In a lot of that episode, he was mad for her. You know, he kind of like wrapped the narrative around her. And he even wrote a blog post called The Tragedy of Young-un Kim, I think.
Yeah.
Like, kind of playing off the tragedy of the Six Marys thing. Yeah. And like, it's like, wow. I mean,
that's, he got
a few minor details mixed up. It's so hard to get them all perfect. But like, it's great. It's cool that he like was really standing up for this person, you know, like,
yeah.
And that's what I mean when I say in that podcast, they get mad about the right things, you know, and like, they're not like not sociopathic. They're not like removed from the empathy of it, you know?
Oh yeah. Okay. Now you're bringing up something. In the very beginning of this interview, you said something about Moon getting connections with the largest insurance company in Korea at the time. And that's what really trampolined him into success. That was Annie Choi's family. Sam Park's mom.
Wow.
Moon's illegitimate child. So Moon wanted to marry into this family for money, made it providential, something about the Bible, and then had Sam. And that was his claim to billions.
So that was him cleansing the womb
of the two sisters. Yeah.
In order to have that. Yeah. So that's Picaroon in a nutshell. Before the Unification Church, there's a book called Change of Blood Lineage and Ritual Sex in the Unification Church by Kirsten L. Nebelin. Anyway, you can Google it. And yeah, it talks about how like their Moon had weird fringe sex cults where he was like the leader. And there were a few of these different group, fringe groups in Korea where even sometimes it was a female leader, where you had to have sex with the leader in order to be in the group and be saved or whatever. So that's where the Unification Church started originally. And it's, that's why we call it a sex cult.
Yeah, man, the more we talk about it, it's a military cult, a psychological cult, a sex cult. But really just naming these key figures, like if you tie it all together, and we haven't tied it all together, it's just too much. There's just too much. But we've named so many great jump like starting points for people who are curious about the real history of the Unification Church. I mean, the names that we have dropped, if you just, you could tell a whole story about every single person we just talked about.
Yeah. And that's why there's not a definitive documentary, because it would have to, it's just, people probably just get exhausted and they're like, I can't do that.
Yeah, because it's not about Moon. It's about the people he had near him that established, I mean, Papa San Che, Young-un Kim, David Kim, Bo-hee Park, and his entire family. Like these guys are huge, significant figures that have been kept in the shadows. So the real agenda of the whole Moon organization is kind of still, I feel like the Moon family is still just a distraction from the real story. It's crazy.
Oh yeah, that's a great way to put it. It's like the cult is the distraction. It's not that it's secretly a cult. So the cult is the distraction, but yeah, but they feel so confident that they have these public events with like, you know, Newt Gingrich and like Mike Pence and Trump. And like, it's so, that's how confident they feel. I'm like, you know, like their knees, Jesus, that's where like we're speaking up and like that. Why is this accepted? No, be jaded about this. This affects you.
I think Trump and Pence just spoke again on Hak Ja-han's behalf. Like she's the mother of peace. Right. She's doing so much for world peace. And I'm like, what fucking peace? They make weapons. Like they're overfishing the oceans. They're labor trafficking minors. They're forcing marriage. They're sex trafficking of Japanese women and Filipino women. Like people have gone missing after the blessing ceremonies from these Asian countries. Like this is not peace. What peace? What have they actually done? Show me real hard evidence of peace. You're just speaking words that aren't true.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's a mega church. It's just like mega church makes peace because a bunch of people get together and get excited. Like, is that, you can do that with like a Comic Con or as I found, like I've left comic conventions have with the same feelings of after a Unification Church workshop of like, oh, I'm gonna miss my friends until next year. You know, you can create that in things that aren't these grandiose, sociopathic, world savior, you know, impossible things.
Wow. So. Wow. I love that. Jesus. I wanted to ask you, I was really touched when you said you kind of felt dead inside after SDF. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about the journey from you feeling dead inside to whatever you're feeling now?
I mean, I think that's part of why I'm a whistleblower. Just like unfucking. Well, I think, part of me is mad that I lost. I felt like I lost something or something got suppressed out of me or just like pushed out of me, you know, because of what you said, the 18 to 25 span of like when it really helps formulate who you are as an adult. Like, yeah, I do. I feel used. I feel, you know, and I think, and like, I can imagine a lot of people, maybe someone's listening to this podcast for the first time and hearing me and they're like, that's not how I feel on STF. I was blah, blah, blah. Like, but you know, I'm in my 40s now and it's, you know, it took a long time to realize that, you know, that this was wrong. And what it also took was like hanging out with people who just come from normal families with no agendas except to like raise their kids healthy and like productive and, you know, feeling loved and validated. When I spent time in those families' houses during college, that's when it, you know, no one had to explain anything. I just saw how the parents were. They knew all the video games and the movies that the kid liked. And I'm like, what? The kid has so much power, like in this family and in the Unification Church, you're taught to subjugate your children. You know, they're the object, you're the subject as parents. And, you know, it's very authoritarian. And I just realized like families in the Unification Church are constantly performing. Like you're just constantly performing. You're this like pseudo, you're this character for the cult leader. Like, and you know, a lot of them are going to listen to this and be like, that's not true. But spend some time away from it. Spend like a month away from it with people who aren't in the church or in any kind of group like that. And, you know, the autonomy and just like you can assert your needs and what you want. Like, it's those things that completely on my own in the real world, like I dry up because I can't as easily do those things. And it's hard. And so like, I even need to just be around people like that in order to feel like that's okay to be, to survive as like an individual in the world. So, you know, I think that's something I got just learning from these groups. And then even like, I don't have kids and I don't really want kids. Honestly, I think I'm too kind of traumatized to have kids. I've never had a model of someone who balances work and family. So I'm too nervous about that to have kids. Like, I feel like I'm going to be a workaholic and I don't want to pass that down. So I just want to spend time in that ether, you know, of just like people who grew up outside of high demand groups. And yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. Actually, another thing that made me go on this whistleblower road was I'm really into comedy, and I was more into stand-up comedy like in years past, but I was listening to this radio station on iTunes at the time, and it just plays a bunch of different stand-up comedy clips. And one comedian talked about the death of his parents on stage. And I was like, wow. And he turned into a joke. He was like, I don't know who it is to this day. I think it was Christopher Titus, but I'm not sure. But he said, you know, I remember one night, the police called me and they said, I'm sorry, but your father died in a car accident. And then, you know, there was like a pause. And then I was like, how's the car? You know, like, so that was the joke. And I was like, whoa. And the whole reason I'm doing this, you know, I mean, it was Trump too, that made me more public. But even before that, like years before that, I decided to investigate more because I was like, well, what's my deepest, darkest secret, you know, that I can tell? And it's like, oh, obviously, I grew up in a cult. And, you know, at the time in 2009, I didn't feel like I wanted to speak back to media and be like, you guys say it's a cult and it's all this stuff. But like my experience was, it was okay. And I have good friends and it was international. And like, you know, I wanted to defend it kind of, or just speak to the complexity, you know, but I only did like a few weeks of research. And I was like, looking through it from a critical lens for the first time. And I was like, this is all messed up. And everything the news said was absolutely true. Looking at it from someone who has no agenda and is just, you know, like just trying to get by and believes in, you know, just autonomy and trusting people, and that you don't need something imposed on you in order to correct yourself inherently, which is what a lot of these, you know, religious groups do, and it controls people. So anyway, that's my long-winded answer to your question. And I really appreciate this. And it's really awesome to see other people speaking out. And you guys like, and that we help each other with research and stuff so that it's not all in one person. And, you know,
Yeah. Thank you, Teddy. Wow. Oh man. I feel like this is another cataclysmic event, the Shinzo Abe shooting, for young Moonies to investigate, kind of like you did. Like, a lot of people want to defend the church and the culture, but you kind of, when you go into it with an open mind to look into all the connections and all the corruption and all the trafficking, it's undeniable. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, we are part of something maybe a little more destructive than we thought. And so I'm really glad we can put this information out there for, I think there's going to be a new wave of a lot of people leaving and looking for a place to land.
And
you've been building a large platform for years with all the different podcasts and TV shows that you've done. So I thank you for doing that, for creating this place, and for being inspired to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I wouldn't be able to do it or feel as confident without the help of, you know, groups like ICSA, ICSA, and just, there's a lot of cult scholars out there who are telling me my life back to me. They're like, did you experience this? It's like, did your mom give away a child? I was like, yes, that's a thing in cults. Like, yeah,
it is.
They're so simple. Yep. If you look in the book, so Roseanne Henry.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The therapist.
That happened to her. Well, it was that the leader coercively took the daughter to, like, she felt entitled to, like, kind of over time kind of guilted her into like taking her daughter, and then like excommunicated the parents left when they realized it was a cult. They were like, this is so messed up, like when they realized what they were made to do. Wow. And, you know, eventually they had a reunion, but it was so hard. But that's the level of power that some of these people go to. That's the length. I know in the church, it's like, it's a little different because it's not just the leaders. It's, you know, there's a lot of, because it's enmeshed. It's like you're one big family. So you see giving away kids is like not a big deal. You know, it's like, if you love someone, give them a kid. But from the people who that's happened to, I know that there's so much trauma, and I hope that they can get their stories heard and understood.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like through talking about all this stuff, it puts it out there. It creates like a vision board so you can finally make sense of all the chaos inside. But I've noticed after talking about this stuff for a year now is that I'm starting to actually feel feelings instead of used to just intellectualize feelings. Like, I'm crying because my body's upset because this happened and that and that and that and that and that. And that this has to make sense because there has to be a reason behind these feelings. But now I can feel a feeling and actually be like, oh, this is just a feeling. Oh, great. This is, you know, I don't have to make sense of it. It's just a feeling. I don't know. That's a big.
That's huge. Yeah. Just letting the feeling pass through, you know? Yeah. Processing it.
I feel like that's a big victory.
Oh no, absolutely. That's like way to learn to be human, you know, like for the first time.
We have to learn how to be human.
Yeah, exactly. What I see it as is, it's kind of funny. It's like, because of this, you know, I see our families as we were raised by a system. We weren't really raised by a family. It was raised by a system. And, and I think in order to feel like it's okay to like release your feelings, you have to feel safe. You have to feel like people intimately know you in like a structure that acknowledges you and your personality. And so like, I recognize that, and it hurts to know that, like, I feel like I have to put those pieces around me and like build those walls myself in a safe space, or just be alone in order to, which isn't as validating, you know, to release those feelings, you know. Yeah. Journal writing helps, things like that. Having a therapist, of course, is great, but just like, that's one of the things that my heart breaks for, is just that, you know, you grow up in something that doesn't acknowledge you. And as an adult, you have to live by you, that thing that is developed. So like, you know, you can always start later, you know, you can, I know that I'm doing things I enjoy more now, that, you know, I still sometimes kind of dress like a teenager, like, but that's okay. Like, I acknowledge that, you know, I was raised by a system and I have to discover things about myself a little later. You know, the brain, it does have developmental years. Yes. And it's like, you know, baking a cake, and once it's baked, when you're an adult, like, it's hard to go back and change the ingredients. But, you know, science also says that the brain's plasticity lasts until you're dead. So
yeah, we're very plastic. When you said raised by a system, that invalidated feelings, I feel like with the creation of all these podcasts, and I just want to name a few that have really given me the space to feel my feelings, because they confirm the realities we grew up in. It's just, the falling out was one of them. I got to feel my anger. I got to see it reflected back at me, that that's valid. That anger is valid. Jane Austen Culture Night with Akina Cox and Laurel Nakai, like, that reflects a lot of like some of the humor with how odd and abusive the arranged marriages were, just kind of just the weird dynamics and yeah, just all these new activists coming on. They're creating a space where you can feel your feelings. Like, I'm sure plenty of people listen to this podcast and can actually start feeling their feelings, like, reflected back at them from all the different guests, as yourself and all the other dozens of people that have been on this podcast. So, it's amazing.
Yeah. It's kind of sad, but also, you know, it's sad, but true. But like, you know, when we were kids, we had to help each other raise each other, 'cause we never knew when our parents were going to be home. And it's like, we're still doing that.
Yeah. Old patterns. Yeah. Right. But we're also not an island, you know, people need people. And
yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
There's just another thing I was going to say was, like, I had to wait until I got to a certain age, and, you know, psychologically your parental instincts kick in when your brain gets older, like around your 30s or something, you know, there's like different stages of the brain. So it took me to be like a parent age person to raise myself in those ways that were missing, you know, like, and again, yeah. Like if my parents ever hear this, like, you know, I just want to tell them that, you know, this really isn't your fault. Like, you didn't start the group. You didn't have the original agenda to have a bunch of people join and build this system. You were in it and it was very powerful. And they want to always tell me, like, no, this was our fault. It was us. Like, stop blaming the group. Da, da, da. And it's like, well, you need to study about cults because, like, you know, we're coming from different angles. And the Unification Church is going to blame the members. So I'm like, you're reflecting that same freaking thing. So anyway, but yeah, it took me to be an adult to be like, oh, this is what it's like to, like, care for, you know, a personality and help it grow, like, to guide me in, like, doing that in ways that my parents couldn't because of the coercions of the church. Yeah.
And I do want to say, like, our parents also came from an era of, like, Jim Crow laws, and they were raised in the Catholic Church that were murdering children. Like, I mean, my parents were raised in abusive Catholic organizations, and my mom was raised in Japan where women weren't recognized as humans. So, like, our parents came from a very oppressive place, and they thought they were doing, it sounded nice, world peace. Women's rights, Women Federation for World Peace, mixed race marriages, and yeah. And equality. Like, I can kind of understand the appeal of joining something like the Unification Church. I hate to admit it, but, like, it was also a different time back then.
Yeah, yeah. It's the 60s hippies and revolution. And, you know, my dad said that after JFK was assassinated, like, that, he said that was the first time I felt like America was, like, something's wrong. And, like, it just, you know, it's funny because after that, like, punk and heavy metal came out, like, the nation was angry, you know, like, so it's interesting.
Yeah, a big thing. Yeah, a lot of response, a lot of music responded to the Cold War, and there's a lot of great music, revolutionary music that came about. It was a time of revolution and rebellion and trying to make a better world. And I think, in a way, this whole cult awareness network is also trying to do that, like, wake up into a better world. And hopefully we can learn from the mistakes of our parents by not joining oppressive organizations or furthering violence or furthering extremism. You know, we'll just do the best we can. I think something beautiful that we have now is the internet, and we don't have to resort to violence when we have our voice, that we actually listen to each other.
Yeah, I'll add another thing. I talk a lot about this stuff on TikTok, actually. Well, you and I both know there's, like, tons of non-disclosure stuff happening. So, yeah, but we'll see who actually finishes documentaries. Like, we've been getting so many messages and calls, and, like,
yeah, but it's a rat race, isn't it? Like, every other day, there's, hey, mm-hmm. Would you like to have an interview about the moon?
So, just, you know, word to the wise for anyone who gets hit up like that. It is exciting. It's like, whoa, someone wants to listen to this story that I'm trying to get out. But just be careful, like, be critical, like, reach out to people who have been, you know, contacted before. Some are better than others. Some of them might, you know, have some shady stuff in their contract. So just FYI, if you're a whistleblower, teddyhose.com, go to, like, the press page, you'll see more of my, like, whistleblower stuff.
Cool. Well, I look forward to seeing more documentaries from you, more interviews from you, more podcasts. It was awesome to have you on the show to talk about the whole range of things we talked about. And I liked it. It was interesting. Thank you for your insight. And just talking with me this afternoon.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, just knowing you when you were a little kid, I feel like there's, like, a connection there. Like, it almost feels like familial, you know, we share a similar past. So we were under the same roof.
Yeah.
In a crappy dorm building, but wow. You know, it is what it is. Yeah.
Wow. I just remember, like, a huge picture of River Moon. It was like, yes, this is a Mooney dorm. Like,
I know. There's no hiding it. Oh, sorry, you guys had to go through that.
That's hard. My God. It's so funny.
Yeah.
Let's see. Okay. I want to see if I, I have one more question. Can I ask you one more question?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Wait, one more question is, I looked up to you and all the elders. You were the elder type. You were, you know, who Like I formed my life after you. Like I saw you go to SCF. I saw a few others go to SCF. Like that was the life course. It was so easy for me to see an established life course. I knew I had to, you know, Camp Sunrise, SCF, yeah. workshops at UTS, like service repeat, all these things. I watched you. Mm-hmm. Who did you look up to? Or how did that even start?
Okay. Well, being in the Tarrytown community, yeah, it was a lot of the older families. So we had like Hyungs, you know, older brother. That's how you say older brother in Korean. We called them like John Hyung or Tom Hyung, you know, like, which is weird. But it was just the older second generation in the area. There was one family, the Park family, who moved from LA to Tarrytown, Irvington in New York. In maybe the late 80s. And it was interesting because we were all kind of, you know, the kids who we knew about the moons and we just stuck with the program. And, you know, some of the oldest, they were seen as perfect children. There were no restrictions yet on because they had certain expectations of how they were going to be. So a lot of their parents let them watch MTV and get into music and culture. And, you know, and it's like they made restrictions later. But so I looked up to these kids as like, whoa, they're cool. They're in with the culture and they dress in these brands and stuff like that. The Hyungs, you know, like my oldest brother was part of that group. And they had like church bands and stuff like that. They were really into music. They all seemed, yeah, like, I don't, even when they were in Korea, they got into like metal. They were listening to Iron Maiden and Megadeth. And I'm like, what is this? I'm so confused. But you know, it was cool. Like it was okay to be cultured back then. So I looked up to them. And again, like this, the Park family that moved there, there was like, you know, a few of the brothers. They were older too. They were all like chill, you know, like they all seemed, I was like, oh, maybe LA is more chill than Westchester, which is like where old money from New York City moves, you know. Like it's funny, I've learned over the years that you know, living in New York City now on and off in my adulthood, people like sneer at Westchester because they're like, oh, they're just like cold, uptight people with money. And I'm like, oh, thank God. I just thought that's how the world was on top of being in a cult. So I just thought everyone was right. Yeah. Like everywhere else, wow. We were like Westchester, you know, not to say all of Westchester, like, but I think particularly, you know, because the Moons lived in super expensive place in these fancy estates. Like we were around those type of people and I just, you know, nothing to relate with anyone around them. So again, more coercion to like, you know, confide in the church community. But yeah, I think because the Park family was maybe higher up the ladder, like their dad earned the status of being called Tiger Park, you know, which is like where, it's Moon he appointed this name Tiger to like the special, like super members who were like leaders and, all Korean. So
I thought Bohee Park and Tiger Park were the same person. They're different.
Oh yeah, they're different.
Oh fuck. Okay.
Yeah. And Jesus. It's sad because that father of that Park family, I don't know his real name, but he died after doing like a 40-day fast. So yeah, I know. I think he did too many of them or something.
For the listener, 40-day fast, we literally mean no eating or drinking food. No eating any food for 40 straight days.
Yeah, like, no, he probably drank water, but yeah.
Drank water, okay.
Yeah, so, but like, I think because they were like more of a prominent family, they were, you know, they were more chill. They're like, hey, what a, you know, like, let's all be cool. And they were actually like genuinely nice people. Like we all looked up to the Parks. Like they were just the laid back family. They weren't looking over their shoulder as much. One of the Parks, one of the older brothers, he talked back to Sean Moon when he tried to chastise, them at the DC church. Yeah, ask Elgin about this. There's a story where they just went on and on. And he's like, you know, it's not that bad. Or you don't have to be like this. I was like, oh. I wasn't there, but I was trying to get him on the Falling Out podcast just to tell that story. But he was like, nah, he's like, he doesn't want to go back. You know, they're not everyone is investigative like us. Like a majority of people just want to move on and, you know. But there's like a cluster of us who talk about everything. But anyway.
Right. Yeah. And it's
mostly the Parks. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And it's great. It's great because the few of us that are investigative, we create the safe place for other people to figure out and, you know, not internalize and repress all this stuff. It's real. It really happened. This was our history.
Yeah. And it's funny because like I was like second generation leader in Seattle with my sister. You know, we were leading the programs there and the little workshops just to like, you know, we were kind of taking what we learned in New York and bringing it to like Seattle when we moved there. But I also realized it stunted my growth. I think anyone who grew up in a church as a kid where they had to be in a leadership position, it's like then you can't explore and you're the uptight one in other scenarios where like everyone's chill and having a good time, or maybe they're having drinks or, you know, at a party, and you're the one who's like, you know, this, it's like Patty Simcox from Grease, if you remember. Yeah, who's like the super like, hey, did everyone put in their photos for the yearbook on the deadline time? You know, I was becoming too much like that. So after I was that leader guy in high school, I was like, man, I got to like now have an adolescence. Like, I don't want to go back to that like ever. Like, I don't want to be responsible for kids anymore. But you know, now, so like everything I do like online or whatever, and talking with people, like I try not to play that role, but I think I kind of do. I don't know. I try to be as hands-off as possible and like, don't come to me with all your problems. Like, I mean, you can talk about it and stuff, but don't make me an older brother figure. I'll be a fellow adult reference, but I am not taking ownership of whatever. I'm not going to be a young. I'm just going to be a fellow adult. And like, you know, I guess what I'm saying is it's funny that I'm kind of feeling resonance with that position again.
I mean, there was such a strange power dynamic that shouldn't have never been given or placed on you. There's no room for play. There's no room for carefree development. I mean, no child should be given that amount of responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and I'll pass that up to, yeah, it was nice to have older brothers, you know, or older brother figures in Tarrytown, when I was just so scared of going to school every day and having people find out I was a Mooney who was associated with this big estate, you know, in their town. That's like Boo Radley, you know? So like, and I think I just kind of naturally understood the value of that. And that just kind of emanated maybe just like in some ways. Yeah.
So that's how our culture was formed.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Cause now it's just kind of like pathways in the brain that are just carved out. Now it's just carved. The path is just go to a Mooney school, go to GPA, do your 7-year course, get blessed, like have families, procreate. It's just carved. It's been carved for decades.
Yeah. It's like the older brothers, like suddenly they knew we had the most influence maybe. And a lot of us went astray, AKA grew up and read books, like, but yeah. And had experiences that are human. And Elgin talks about this too. And I've always felt this way about it too, ever since I started doing my activism, is like, no, like we're going to tell the younger generations, like what really happened and what the process, you know, it's like, I want to be able to tell people like, you know, these are the things I thought about and this is what I've been through, but you know, it's always going to be tainted with the church parents and adults, like telling kids that, oh, they're trying to pull you away. Like they used to tell me, and in order to like make me not trust the world and make me a paranoid little bitch, you know? So, but like, yeah, no, it's natural. It's just organic. Like, you can put whatever label you want on it, but you know, whatever is, and you can't control that. So that's it.
That's powerful. So powerful. All right, cool. All right, Teddy, that was it. That was my last burning question. Thank you so much for answering that as you have. It puts a lot of perspective into things. So yeah, just appreciate all the work you're doing. Look forward to, you know, seeing more podcasts and interviews and documentaries with your face in them. And if anybody wants to reach out to Teddy, or you have any questions that you think Teddy could answer, because you're an older generation, you've seen things that people haven't seen. Yeah, if I get any questions from the listeners, I'll forward them to you, or they can reach you personally, or.
Oh, yeah, you can just write to teddyhoseworks@gmail.com.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. And I want to say, anybody that's a fan of Falling Out with Elgin Strait, Teddy is the graphic designer. He does all of the album covers, So yeah, you have seen his work before.
And also I'll just put in there that I also like, I'm like, oh, Elgin, you should talk to this guy here. Let me hook you up.
Yeah.
And so it's a community effort also, but Elgin is like, you know, he's organizing everything. He does a lot of research. We all help him because he's like the driving force. He's the engine of that. So it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys are, I'm so glad he's getting some help. So guys, you've had a couple hours with Teddy Hose and myself. I hope you've enjoyed this trip down memory lane and the many places it took you. If you have anything you want to say, reach out to me at RenRobot on Instagram and Facebook. And if you want to be part of the show, message me too there. So yeah, Teddy, I appreciate you. We'll catch back up some other time, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this was great.
Yeah, I hope you have
I'm out of words.
Yeah, I hope you have a wonderful week, weekend, and thanks for thanks for telling everybody. I used to be an enthusiastic kid that just wanted to show the world some cool art, because I feel like, yeah, this, also that never died.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, I mean, that's what I saw. That's one of the main things I was coming into this. Like, people should know how Renee was, like, minus like the growing up with all this craziness. Yeah. Like, yeah. Just pure kid Renee. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. That's real cool. Yeah. All right, Teddy, I'll catch up with you again soon. And yeah, take care, everybody. Take care of your mental health, whatever that looks like. And yeah, we'll talk again soon.
Bye.